Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another guest episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show. So my special guest today, I'm super excited to chat with, is Adam Chickman. So Adam works for Active Prospect, and he is a first-time revenue leader who's moved from divisional VP of sales to divisional VP of sales with responsibilities over client success to VP of sales, managing sales, customer service, and business development over the course of his first year in management. So I think this is fun to talk to somebody who's done some moves, moved up in an organization and around all in a short period of time, and that perspective some from the sales side and the early leadership side. So he's helped his company grow revenue 50% year over year and scale the enterprise sales and customer service org from 9 to 27 people over the course of 2020, which is interesting year. And again, all of this while being his first year in revenue leadership role. Adam, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Thank you, Jason. It's really exciting to be here.
So the first part that I want to talk about, which is, I'm going to say funny story because the laughing helps to keep from crying. You were living in the Bay Area. You were working remote for Active Prospect, living in San Francisco, working remote. Home office is in Austin, Texas. So you decide early 2020 to, hey, I'm going to move. I'm in a leadership role. I'm going to go be closer to the team. I'm going to work in the office, be there hands-on every day, get going. And then what happens?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. I actually moved out here to Austin full-time January 1st for all the reasons you just mentioned, wanting more face time with other folks at the company. And then, of course, with the pandemic and us going into lockdown right around March 15th, I was in the office a total of 10 days before we shut her down. So the move didn't work out exactly like I hoped, but there's definitely worse places to be than Austin, Texas.
Yeah, and I've heard many stories like this where it's somebody moves, things happen, goes in lockdown, they're in a new strange city, they don't really know anybody, right? Not that you have much you could do anyway, even in your home area, but then it's like, okay, starting this new adventure, locked indoors, living in a new place.
That's right. Yeah, and I think everyone is facing challenges in different ways at this time. It's definitely challenging to lead a team when everyone is completely remote and over half the people on your team are people that you've actually never met in person before. It's just tough to build those types of relationships. But I would say one silver lining is just being forced to stay inside and stay in one location when you did have such a crazy travel schedule, as I'm sure a lot of people listening and a lot of people who've been on the show have had. I can't imagine having the type of year that we've been having and growth that we're going through right now had I continued my travel of being on the road once or twice a week. So just to look on the bright side and one positive, I think it has been helpful to really be forced into one location and be able to communicate with people at the scale that I had by way of being in one spot.
Now, when you said that you were on the road once or twice a week, where were you going or who were you going to see? What were you doing?
Yeah, so that's been kind of one of the early lessons for me moving from an IC into more of a leadership role. And back when I was an individual contributor, I was constantly meeting with prospects, meeting with clients. And as I was trying to juggle moving from an individual contributor into sales leadership role with a relatively young sales team, I wanted to make sure that I was on the road with our sales reps. And I think it was really valuable when we were able to be on the road together from a learning perspective, as well as a, we got to do everything we can to make sure that we're getting these deals across the line. And you could just have much more effective conversations in person. But one of the things that I've realized is there is a difference between sales manager and sales leader. And sales manager is joining your reps on every single call. Sales leader doesn't always allow you to do that. That's more creating the high level strategy. That's hiring to continue building out your team. And that's just something that you can't do if you're on the road like I was.
Makes total sense. It's tough to scale that. It's tough to scale on the road with members of your team to go to their appointments, help them close those deals, even jumping on Zoom calls now in this day, to do that every single time it doesn't work. And as I'm hearing you talk about that difference between a manager and a leader and coach somewhere in the middle of that, mm-hmm. I'm always thinking about like sports related, and I really enjoy basketball. And so the coach is on the side. The coach can't do the play for them. They can kind of direct and say, hey, here's what we should run. But at some point, once the game starts or once everybody's on the court, the coach is just watching and hoping. I mean, everything was done in advance, right? The practices, the mindset, the strategies. Once the whistle goes, man, it's no longer in the coach's hand, right? It's in the player's hand. And there's so many sales leaders who feel like they've got to manage. They've got to do it. Like they've got to take the ball out of their player's hands and make the game-winning shot or else.
I love that analogy. And I don't know if I've shared this in previous conversations, but I actually played baseball all throughout college. So I relate a lot of sales and things in my professional career back to my baseball career early on. And I think one of my earliest lessons in management came from when I started coaching. So going into my junior year of college, I actually started coaching a 12U baseball team. And that was some of the most fun I ever had on the field. But one of the things that I learned right away is that any success that you have is directly derived from your team's success. And it's all about putting the best field on the team and enabling them to be able to succeed. And when they do succeed, people will celebrate it as your victory, but you aren't winning unless they're winning. So making sure that you give them the tools to be successful, you're coaching them so that they can go succeed. But then to your point, there is that point at which you have to just step back and say, okay, the team is out there. I can't be the one to make the play anymore.
And I think that's really the big key. And I think that's the difference between managers and somebody who's directing and doing everything at a micro level, almost micromanaging, sometimes mm-hmm. with the micromanagement pressure and sometimes just not. And there's a place for all of that, right? There's a place where a manager needs to be involved. And then there's a coach. Then there's a leader, which even like you're talking about is the leader role that you are looking at taking the further out view is not even the coach on the field or on the sideline. It's the back office or the front office who's the manager of the team at a higher level, who's making the moves and the decisions and figuring out the strategies. And I think within each organization, there's always those different levels. And I'll tell you, and I don't know if you've seen this, one of the biggest problems I've seen with organizations is they generally expect, let's say, a sales manager or somebody at that level to be doing the high level stuff when they really just need to be on the field. Like some of them mm-hmm. at one level needs to be on the field and stop expecting them to also come up with strategies and groundbreaking ideas. Like sometimes they're just in the trenches and that's perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it is two different roles, being in the trenches and being there to create the high level strategy. And both are needed and both are important. So I would say the one caveat to our analogy here, being a coach and not being able to be on the field, is that in sales management, there are times you can be on the field with your players. You can join those calls. But what I've found is fighting the urge to do that, the more you could allow your team to win and at times fail by themselves, the more it then enables them to go produce. So it's the more scalable route. Whereas if you're the one that's actually handling every single call, that just doesn't scale. It ends up challenging your team to go out there and become the salespeople that they can be.
Makes total sense. And I think there's that balance, right, of giving the feedback, looking at the replays, looking at the game footage, jumping in the game for them. It's a delicate balance. Also depends on where you want to go and how independent you want your team to be and or how much you're going to need them to need you. So one of the things that you've discovered in your leadership journey in this short year, but wild year of all years that you picked to go into sales leadership and revenue leadership is mission-centric sales and business. Expand on that and what that means to you.
Yeah, no. So we talk a lot about our mission here at Active Prospect. Our mission is to make what we call consent-based marketing the best channel for customer acquisition. And I think taking a mission-centric approach, to me, really boils down to creating alignment and providing clarity. So I see a mission-centric approach as first creating alignment across your sales org and the broader team. So I think of it kind of like how Simon Sinek, for those who have seen his famous TED Talk about start with why, it's all about uncovering your why, what's driving your company and what's driving you to do what you do every day. So once you understand that as a company, it allows the entire team to get behind this mission and make sure that you're building products in support of it. And then from a sales org perspective, it really aligns the entire process from SDR all the way to client success manager, so that sales development reps who are the tip of the spear are out there promoting what you're doing because they believe it in their bones that you can actually help customers achieve results that they wouldn't be able to achieve without you. From there, it creates a seamless continuum where the sales directors are able to pick up the, take the baton, so to speak, continue the conversation to gain commitment from those customers to join you and your company on this mission. And then finally, the CSMs, once that prospect becomes a customer and signs on the dotted line, they're there to ensure that you're providing those outcomes that they originally signed up for and that you're achieving this mission together. So the first piece, I think, is really creating that alignment amongst your own team. And then from there, by also taking the mission-centric approach, it allows you to create alignment within your customers. So one of the challenges that I think every sales leader is going to face is, what markets do you go after? How do you know who your target customers are? And for me, a clear mission gives you clarity on what customers you want to go after, because those are the customers, or those are the prospects that are facing these types of challenges that you solve. So having that clarity allows you to focus your efforts on the right companies, which I relate back to something I actually read in your book that I loved, which is all about being honest by saying no. So when you know exactly what problems you're there to solve, it allows you to be much more specific with who you work with and selective. And you could share with them, this is what we're here to do. These aren't problems that you're thinking of, or these aren't the goals that you're going after. We're happy to make an introduction to a different company, but this is why we're here. So lastly, the mission-centric approach, I think, helps you make sure that you're aligned with the right champions at each company, because especially as you go into the larger enterprise, it's not always clear who's tasked with what at each company. So when you could be really clear about why you as a company exist, it allows you to make sure that you're only working with the right contacts.
So first off, always going to be my favorite when you mentioned the book and something I have in there. And I love how you tied it in with the mission of an organization, not just sales, right? So the book is mostly written for salespeople. And like you said, the value of saying no, which is so important, because then that's that dividing line of who you want to work with and who you don't, right? Unless you're selling something where everyone wins. And then you're taking it to that next level, which is, as an organization, who do we want to work with and who do we not want to work with? Like, who's just not a good fit? Who do we not serve? And even large companies, if you look at Apple, like, they've drawn a line in the sand. There's the people they serve and the people that aren't in their tribe and they don't necessarily want to deal with, especially if you look at computers, right? Very specific what they do. So I love how you brought that in, everybody knowing which direction to go because there is a mission and a focus. And I've seen that with individuals and with companies where you can tell from the outside that they don't have that mission clearly defined. They don't have that vision. They don't have the core values, because everyone's just doing their own thing, trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And to go even further with the benefit of identifying who you don't want to work with, and as you say, being honest by saying no, I think, as you pointed out, which I love, it helps build trust, which will then get you referrals. Because if I tell you, Jason, I understand what you're trying to solve, that's just not what we do, but this is who I'd recommend you speak with, you're then going to feel much more comfortable recommending one of your friends to work with me. So over the long term, I'm going to increase revenue because more people are going to feel comfortable and know that they can trust me. So we'll gain more customers. But I think there's also a more immediate economic benefit when you're working in industries that are based on subscription models like SaaS. And in SaaS, a lot of the revenue from any given customer will come in years 2, 3, 4, 5, and beyond. So if you could get really specific about who you're working with, you could avoid the churn that happens after year one of a contract and allow you to actually maximize your margin and focus spending time with the customers that are going to be a good fit. And then I think the other major benefit of being very clear about who's not a fit for you it allows you to build trust with yourself so that when you do make a recommendation and tell someone that I think you should be working with us for this reason, you could say it with more conviction because you know that you have their best interest at heart.
So true. And I love that part, especially what you touched on about the revenue and the challenge I see. Obviously, for leaders listening, it's on one side of the conversation. For the salespeople listening to this podcast or watching this, it's on the other side. But most of the time, salespeople, sellers are looking at the short term. They want to close that deal. They want to make that deal happen. They want to hit their numbers for this week, this month, this quarter. They're thinking about their bonus. They're thinking about their commission. They're thinking about their job, right? Like sometimes it's not, hey, I'm going to make extra money. It's I'm going to have a job. And so I better get this closed. And then it turns out to be a not good fit for the company, or the expectation isn't set properly of what's involved, which is huge, especially subscription model, especially SaaS. Mm-hmm. Nothing is perfect. No solution is perfect. Nothing will ever be the right thing all the time. And so there's always trade-offs, one or the other. And salespeople sometimes can just show all the highlights, not mention anything bad. And then what happens, like you said, 9 months in, 12 months in, contract renewal, company says no, they don't continue. And then it's a loss. Like that deal was actually a loss to the business. And I think it's important to align everybody long term and say, we need clients that will be with us for 3 years or 4 years. That's our goal. And when we do that, we're signing up the right people.
Absolutely. And you know, to be perfectly honest, it's not always easy to make those decisions. To your point, if looking for short-term gain, sometimes you want to just sign the client, but then you realize after taking a step back that that's not going to be in their best interest. And therefore, long-term, it's not going to be in your company's or your as a sales professional's best interest. And I think this is part of the reason why you see some sales professionals jump from company to company. It's because they haven't taken the long-term view. So they haven't built up that equity with the market that they serve, where people know that if I'm working with Jason, I can really trust when he makes a recommendation, I should follow that recommendation. So to me, it all comes back to making a clear decision as a company and as an individual. Do we want just a short-term gain, or are we in this for the long haul? Do we want to build a career? Do we want to build a company that's going to last?
So one of the other things that you shared with me before we recorded for the podcast that I wanted to touch on was being maniacal about that mission. So there's one thing to have a mission, right? There's one thing to have some nice crap on the wall that sounds good. Maybe it's in a plaque, or maybe it's on everybody's signature. Maybe it's on the letterhead. I don't know, right? I've seen it all. And the company checked the box and said, yes, HR, fine. We have a mission. We have a vision. We have core values. Leave us alone. Just let us do our thing, right? That's on one end of the spectrum, if they have it at all. Then the other one is literally living it and being a maniacal, using your word, which is just being so driven. But let me ask you, and I didn't set you up for this in advance, but come on. I mean, you guys are just doing lead generation and helping companies with content marketing, right? How can you be maniacal about that? And that,
yes, I should say, actually, hearing it repeated back to me, the word maniacal does sound a little intense, though I'm sure that's,
I love
probably
it,
how, that's probably how a lot of people, especially active prospect, would describe me, the maniacal mission guy. But actually, one thing to clarify, as a company, we don't do lead gen ourselves. We're a software company. And to go back into the mission-centric approach, our mission is to make consent-based marketing the best channel for customer acquisition. And consent-based marketing, lead gen is definitely a synonym for that. So for those that don't come from the digital marketing world, I'll just unpack that quickly and provide a more concrete example of what consent-based marketing is. So suppose you want to buy a house. To do that, you need a loan. So you're going to go to LendingTree.com and you're going to fill out information about yourself. LendingTree is then going to sell that information with your permission to four or five different lenders. Those lenders are then going to call you and compete for your business. So in this example, we believe that consent-based marketing is really advantageous to the consumer, because as LendingTree says, when banks compete, you win. It's advantageous to the lender because they're able to focus their marketing dollars on consumers that have actually given consent to have a conversation or receive information about a product or service like theirs. In this case, it's a loan. And then to the publisher, which is LendingTree, this can be a very lucrative business model. So we believe that done right, consent-based marketing should be the best channel for customer acquisition. best being defined as most scalable, most cost-effective, so lowest customer acquisition costs, and safest. But there's inherent challenges with consent-based marketing. So our platform exists to allow you to integrate with all these different sources so that you could scale really quickly while getting real-time insights into every lead or consumer that's opted in to receive information about your product or service, so that you can make sure you're actually focusing your marketing dollars on the consumers that are most likely to become your best customer, while also verifying and documenting proof of consent so that you can make sure you're doing it in a compliant way. So getting back to your original question, when we talk about how can you be maniacal about something like consent-based marketing or lead generation, it's because we really do believe that done right, this can be better than search where you're paying for clicks. It can be better than display where you're paying for eyeballs. You know that for every X amount of dollars you spend, you are guaranteed contact with a consumer that's looking for a product or service like yours. So we go into each day feeling excited to be able to share this with the broader universe and being able to help our customers actually make this the best channel at their company.
Now, like I said, I did not warn you about that, that I was going to semi try to throw you under the bus with that. And I love your response, because this is what I talk to a lot of people about, where maybe they're a salesperson, they're working at a company, and they're selling it, but they don't understand the real impact. They don't understand fully why they should care, right? I've worked with marketing companies. It's like, yeah, I'm helping someone to get more leads or do marketing, but it's like, whatever. But when I hear you talk about it, and literally, obviously, you're passionate about it, and not that I don't think you as a kid grew up thinking, oh man, I just can't wait until I can get into content-based marketing and strategies and help companies with a SaaS platform. Like, this can be so amazing when I can do that as an adult. But you're passionate about it because you know the result for the other person, and it's about them and what it means to them, to your clients, to your customers. And I think that's huge. And exactly what I was hoping you were going to say, which is what you're doing and based on the alternatives and what it means for that company and potentially those employees, job growth, stability, all of these things that come from that. I think that's amazing. And for people listening to this, if you're in leadership, make sure your people understand the value of what you're providing down to the smallest detail, down to people not losing their jobs because you're helping them with X, or somebody being able to afford what they want if it's consumer. And then for salespeople, if you don't know that and you can't clearly talk about what you sell, just like Adam just did, then do more research or find something else that you can be excited about and you know that makes a difference.
Yeah, and I think I feel really fortunate to have the unique point of view that we now have, because a lot of people don't know this, but Active Prospect is actually just about 17 years old as a company. But we just started hitting this hockey stick growth about 3.5 years ago, and there weren't significant changes to the market. We have had some product updates, and I think we have a few exciting ones coming out soon. But the biggest shift is how we've started positioning what we do and telling our story. And it's been focusing more on the why and the mission versus a product-centric focus, which is talking about, we have these cool products. You can figure out different ways that you could use them. We found our customers get more value when, instead of just telling them about the flour, the sugar, and the water, you get prescriptive and you say, this is how you can actually make the cake.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show. Which makes sense, right? I mean, that's where it gets into the age-old features and benefits versus this discussion and salespeople who just want to sell the features and how the widget's made, what the widget does specifically. And no one wants it, right? Like I've done a couple of presentations on it and even had on my podcast, people don't buy drills. They buy holes, right? And they don't even buy holes. They buy something way down the line and you can check out those conversations, but people don't care what the drill does. People don't care about the diamond tip drill bit. Like all they care is, will this get me the hole that I need for whatever I have? And I love that you mentioned that as far as like your growth and the focusing on the end result, right? Here's what you can do with the flour, the sugar, and the water. Here's the cake that you're going to have. Here's what it means. Here's that. Don't worry about the technical stuff. Like, we'll take care of the technical stuff.
Absolutely. No, I use the drill analogy all the time. I love it. And the reality, as hard as it is for us as a software company to sometimes swallow, is that nobody wakes up wanting to buy software. Nobody says, I'm going to go buy some software today. They wake up wanting to solve the problems that kept them up the night before. So the more you could connect the dots for them, which is, I feel your pain. I know what you're going through. This is how we could help you achieve better results. And then, of course, back that into how your specific product can help solve that. The more success you're going to have and the more successful your customer is going to be, because they'll have a clearer definition of what success looks like and how you could help them get there.
And that shift is huge. And I've heard that a few times before, which is people don't wake up in the morning thinking about buying some software today. Like, this is going to be an amazing day. I can't wait to buy some software. Like, I wonder which one I'm going to get. But it's interesting because that does happen, especially for consumers, where somebody wakes up and goes, I'm going to go buy a car today. Like, I'm going to buy a car, or I'm going to go buy a TV. Like, my mission today is to go buy a TV and I'm going to get one. And those are two different attitudes, two different sales approaches, two different mindsets, especially from a sales perspective, right? Where it might be about the features and the benefits when someone's on a mission, they're looking for something that's going to solve it, like which is the one that has the best features and benefits for them, for their outcome. But yeah, you're right. I mean, software, they don't do that. Now, one thing I wanted to chat about as well was your leadership journey, right? So we're talking about sales and we're talking about all that, which is awesome. Then there's your path as a leader in your journey here. Let's say it's been 1 year. One of the things you shared with me, and obviously I'm all about authenticity and persuasion and then that transparency and leadership. One thing you shared was obviously going into this with no leadership experience, right? Like going from, like you said, an independent contributor into a sales and leadership role. And there was something you shared with me that you did with your team early on. And what was that? How did you enter into that?
It's been a while since we spoke, so I'm going to have to think back to this. But one of the things that I try to really put focus on is leading by example. And I think it's really important for any team to have what we call a culture of radical candor. So radical candor to me is really the belief that feedback given in the proper way should help everyone improve. And by creating this culture, hopefully it's helping all of your sales reps, all of your client success managers, everyone on your team become the best version of themselves so that they could then help the company help their customers in the best possible way. But to be able to get people to be receptive to feedback, the first step, I think, is showing your own receptiveness to feedback and the fact that you crave feedback yourself. So as part of modeling behavior, one thing I always make sure to do is after every call, even if it's a call that I'm on with a brand new sales rep and it's their very first time and they're looking at me as someone who's been here almost 4 years, the first thing I ask is, what feedback do you have for me? What could I have done better? And I think it just sets a really important tone that everyone can always be improving. And the only way that we're going to improve is if we're open to it and we're soliciting that feedback from one another. So that's one piece. I'd say another really important thing along the lines of modeling behavior is being authentic, because whether you do it with intention or not, the way that you act is going to set the tone for the rest of your team. And not to say this just because we're on the Authentic Persuasion podcast, But I do really believe that people want to buy from genuine people, people who are sincerely out for their best interest. And that stems from your leadership and making sure that you make it clear to the rest of your team, we are here to serve people. We're here to be honest with ourselves and our customers so that when they go out to the market, everyone's coming across with that authenticity.
I know, and I've learned this, I can tune in. I can tell how a leadership style is within an organization just by interacting with frontline people, especially salespeople. Because it's the negative side is the fish stinks from the head down. The positive side is that, you know, it all trickles down from the leadership. As the leader goes, so goes the team, so goes the staff. Mm-hmm. And I learned that years and years ago, even in a non-sales environment. And I love what you said, because it is so true. If you expect your sales team, if you expect your employees, your customer service, your client success, if you expect them to serve the customers and always have their best interests in mind, what are you modeling, right? Same thing, like you said, with the feedback and wanting feedback. The thing is whether it's outward or inward, people can always detect a hypocrite. People can mm-hmm. always detect if it's a do as I say, not as I do mode in a leader. And when that happens, there's a disconnect and it just doesn't work. Hey, I want you to be open to feedback, but don't tell me anything about what I'm doing because I'm here and you're down here. So don't do that. Same thing, like you said, with the serving customers and doing what's right for them and helping the right people buy. And from a leadership perspective, how are you leading your team? Which again, comes back to servant leadership, which is mm-hmm. I'm here to serve you. I'm here to help you. I'm not here because I'm in power and I'm here to control you. I'm here to serve you. If you're winning, I'm going to win. And that's the much better way to go long term.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most important things that any manager or any leader can keep in mind, that any of your success is a direct result of your team's success. So if you want the best talent, A, you need to make it a priority to go out there and cultivate, recruit the best talent. But B, as part of enabling them and retaining them, you have to be there in service to make sure that they're successful. So the old Glengarry, Glenn Ross mentality of always be closing, telling people that they're going to get fired if they don't get a sale across the line, just doesn't work anymore. And I know this because it's not the type of team that I would want to be a part of. So one thing I try to always remind myself as someone who was in an IC role just a year ago, I asked myself the question, how would I want to be treated? What would I be needing in this scenario to be successful? And then as I operate, try to keep that in mind.
Why do you think a leader in your position going into a new role like you did, having not been in a leadership role before, would avoid asking for feedback from the team, I'm going to say below them, like on an org chart, mm-hmm. but why would most, I'm going to say most, be hesitant or hold back or not ask for that feedback?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to throw blanket statements or accusations by any means against, but to me, the first thing I would say is probably a lack of confidence. To ask for feedback shows a level of vulnerability. It's admitting that I am not perfect. And as a leader, if you're admitting that you're not perfect, some people could see that as weakness and see that as my team, why should they look up to me? Why should they give me this authority if I am not perfect? But I think that acknowledgement that everyone can always be improving is actually the ultimate form of confidence, because it's saying, I know that I'm in this role for a reason. I know that I can help you. But even with that, I can still improve. So if I can do that, so can you. So I guess to answer your question, for me, I think it all comes back to confidence or lack thereof, why someone wouldn't ask for that feedback.
I love it. And it is tough to be that vulnerable and say, hey, how did that go? What did you hear? Or how was that meeting? What kind of feedback? I think the one caveat with that, and I know your culture in your company based on people I know that work there, one of which we didn't mention him already, but Ruben Ugarte, he's the one that connected us up. He is amazing. I really enjoy him as a person, what he does and his work ethic. But knowing people at the company, then it's clear the culture is set. Like in what you guys are talking about, you're living. Like I just know mm-hmm. that. The one caveat, the one thing to be careful of, which Cy Wakeman, she wrote this book called No Ego, she talks about in that book and a couple other ones, is also be careful of the feedback that you're getting and from who you're getting it from on your team. And so one of the biggest things is that a lot of times leaders will ask for feedback, And then the people that will give them the feedback are the complainers, the people who aren't winning, the people who aren't doing enough. And then they're complaining about what's not working, or they'll pick apart things because they're looking for something to blame for their lack of success. And so I think that's a good warning for anyone listening to this, is be open to feedback, be vulnerable, have the confidence to ask for that feedback. Just be careful which feedback you listen to and who you're listening to it from, and do they deserve to give you that feedback from what they're doing in their own side.
I think that's a really important clarification, that while you do always want to be soliciting feedback, you are the one that sets the direction for the team and for the organization. So you have to keep that in mind and take all feedback with a grain of salt. If there is a team member that's just rowing in a different direction and they're providing you feedback or complaints because the new direction of the team doesn't jive with what they want to be doing, just because they gave you feedback doesn't mean you actually have to act on it. So to your point, I think it is really important to keep in mind, what are our values as a team? What's our mission? Of course, getting back to mission-centric. And then as a result of that, what are the initiatives we need to take? And as long as the feedback is in service to your mission, your initiatives, and your values, then by all means, if somebody feels you're doing something that's out of line from those, or that you can improve on them, take the feedback, act on it. If somebody does not support your mission, values, or your initiatives, then take the feedback, but you might not want to act on it in the same way.
Yeah, and I think there's a delicate balance between servant leadership and being vulnerable and wanting feedback, and then defaulting to some kind of leadership by consensus, which is where leaders are afraid to upset the group or make a unilateral decision. And so they feel like everyone's got to be on board before they do something. And that's generally not the best way to go, especially if you have a perspective higher up of the battlefield, if you will. Mm-hmm. So one of the things is, you guys, your teams, your company is focused on helping businesses with their marketing, right? And with their strategies. Marketing, sales, business, from what you've seen, especially this year being quite an interesting year, what are you seeing what you would classify as successful companies doing right now in marketing, in sales?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thinking first about our own company, I do feel very fortunate because I know there's a lot of companies that are working incredibly hard. They might be doing all the right things, but given the current state of the world, they're just in an industry that it's impossible for them to succeed in. So obviously, like, travel is a prime example of that. So I think having that appreciation of what industry you're in and not taking that for granted is definitely a big piece. But as far as companies that are succeeding and what they're doing right now, I'd have to think about that. I don't have a better answer for
you. Well, let's do the flip side of it. Is there anything that you're seeing that companies are either trying or stuck in or thinking they've got to do that's just not working? Sometimes those examples are easier to think of. And maybe it's that they're just stuck in their old ways and they're not shifting, they're not changing with the times. I don't know if there's anything you're seeing specifically.
No, we're seeing certain industries are succeeding more than others right now. So as an example, insurance, especially health insurance, has spiked through the roof. Obviously, a lot of people are thinking about healthcare. They want to make sure that they're protected. Home services, on the flip side, it's been a real challenge for those businesses this year, because a lot of companies such as home security that depend on people visiting their home, nobody wants a stranger visiting their house right now. So those have been hit really hard. As far as trends and what's working, what's not working well for companies, I'd have to give that some more thought, but I don't want to offer up an answer without thinking through it some more.
And I'll tell you, to let you off the hook a little bit, I know one of the biggest challenges in that question is that your perspective is going to be the companies that you're dealing with, that you're talking to, that are generally open-minded and moving forward and doing new strategies. And so it's not always the fairest slice of the world, because you're dealing with the companies that want to take action and not seeing as many of the ones that are struggling. So that's totally fair. But let's talk about salespeople. In your experience, yourself with others, is there any mindset? Is there any activity that sets a top salesperson apart?
Yeah, well, one mindset that jumps to mind, I was actually listening to one of your recordings from a few weeks ago with a former CEO of mine, Greg Johnson from Invoca. And I really enjoyed that podcast. And you two were talking about empathy, which is something that we really keep in mind at Active Prospect. And for me, as I think about empathy, especially in times like these, obviously it's understanding the nature of somebody's business right now. And there are certain things that could prohibit somebody from moving forward with a software like ours. Maybe they just don't have any budget. But empathy isn't only about saying, I understand where you are and why you can't move forward. It also could be, I understand where you are, and this is exactly why you need to move forward now more than ever. If your prospect's budget is spread really thin and you have a product that allows them to save money or increase top line, that's more necessary now than ever because they need to be saving money. They need something that's going to be ROI positive. So the current state of the world shouldn't therefore be a reason to not move forward. The current state of the world should be a reason more so than ever that they should be moving forward with you so that they could recognize the upside.
And I think the biggest thing with that is if what you sell actually provides value to your customers, right?
Right.
As long as it's not the 19th CRM out there that they're still never going to use, or the next marketing automation platform that has a couple more bells and whistles that still won't help them move a needle in any direction, or it's another set of knives for their home that they still don't need because they don't cook, those kind of examples. If it's something that actually provides value, I love it. I love exactly what you said, which is now is the time. It's always a time. Like, this will actually help you by making this decision, right? I'm pushing you to do this because I care. If I let you stay where you are, things could go worse for you. And that's not what I'm here to do for you.
Absolutely. And for me, it actually comes back to something we talk about often, which is mother standard. So I love talking about mother standard with the team, which we by no means can claim credit for the term. To my knowledge, it was first established by Cancer Treatment Centers of America. And the idea was treat every customer, treat every patient with the level of care that you would hope somebody treats your own mother. So as we apply that to sales, obviously, you wouldn't want to sell your mom a product that she doesn't need. You wouldn't want anyone trying to convince your mom to spend money on something that's not going to bring her value. But we've gone ahead and kind of broadened the application of mother standard so that it's not just about not selling a product to someone that doesn't actually need it or wouldn't get value. It's when you know that somebody would get value from something, just like you would hope that your mother takes the opportunity to get that value, you make sure that you advocate on their behalf and you recommend that they move forward. So as one example, part of what we do is help identify potentially fraudulent leads. And if my mom started buying leads, my mom, Terry Chickman, who's a retired librarian, I would not let her go ahead and buy leads without fraud detection. I would call her relentlessly until she was actually buying leads in a protected way. So if that's how I would treat my own mom, why are we out there letting our customers or prospects continue to buy leads in an unprotected way? So to me, mother standard, just as much as it's not selling something that somebody doesn't need, it's making sure that if they can really get benefit, you're letting them know and you're advocating on their behalf.
And that all ties back to something you said early on, which is the value in saying no, right? And being honest by saying no and the power that comes with that when it's just not a good fit, right? And you wouldn't want to sell or somebody to sell something to your mother that she didn't need. And when she does, like, okay, gloves are off. Like, you need this. Like, I don't care. Like, and I love your example. Like, I'm just thinking of your mom, retired librarian, buying leads and you not wanting her to get fraudulent leads. And just basically not holding back, right? Like, you're just going to go all out until she gets it and stops doing that. So I love that. For you, what does it mean to be authentic?
Yeah, for me, I think it starts within, and this kind of gets back to the mission-centric approach, understanding your why and truly believing it. So one of the things that we've seen, a lot of our top reps have never actually sold software before. But they came from the market that we serve. So they're acutely familiar with the pain points of the customers and prospects that we're selling to. So they're able to be authentic because they know that we can actually help. So I think the first point in being authentic is making sure that you're representing a company that you believe in their mission and you believe their products can actually add value. Beyond that, as you're communicating with prospects and customers, it just comes back to that honesty and that mother standard that we just talked about. If you know you can help them, don't be shy about it. There's no need to be bashful. But if you don't think you can help them, introduce them to somebody that can, or just let them know, I'm really sorry, but this problem that you're trying to solve isn't something that we really focus on.
And for you, because the next question I would ask is, what does it mean to use persuasion or to sell with persuasion? I feel like you literally just answered it, which is the same answer you have for the authentic piece. Is there anything else to add to that?
No, I mean, I think back to my college classes, and one of the most impactful classes I took was actually persuasion. And of course, we read Cialdini's book. For me, obviously, I don't see myself as a great salesperson. And I think a lot of the best salespeople that I've come across don't see themselves as a great salesperson either. They see themselves more as consultants. And when you really believe in what you're doing and you take a consultative approach, I think the outcome is that you are persuasive, because your belief in what you're selling will rub off on those that you're talking to. So they'll be moved to actually take action. I think when people take the approach of just trying to persuade without actually believing in what they're selling, without taking a consultative approach and understanding the pain points of somebody that they're selling to, that's when I think you get more into the stereotypical car salesman approach of just trying to get somebody to sign on the dotted line so that you could hit your quota. That's at least the type of salesperson that I hope I or anyone on my team would never be.
I love it. And of course, I absolutely agree. So I appreciate that. When you were growing up as a kid, what did you want to be?
Baseball player. Yeah. So all the way through college, I wanted to be a professional baseball player. That was my sole focus. And then I ended up going to the University of Rhode Island to play baseball there, and didn't actually end up playing a whole lot. And sitting on the bench in freezing weather wasn't all that I thought it was going to be. I really missed the California sunny days. So that's kind of where my career went to die. But that's kind of the points that we talked about earlier. I do think a lot of the lessons that you can learn from playing sports in your youth can be applied to career paths such as sales. I know earlier you mentioned I probably never thought that I would be selling software or as excited about consent-based marketing as I am now. But when you actually look at a lot of the same qualities between an athlete and a salesperson, I don't think it's the furthest jump to make.
Definitely is not. At this point in your early career in life and where you're at, what is your definition of success?
Yeah, it's a great question. And that's probably one of my earliest learnings in moving from an IC role into leadership. Now I define my success as my team being successful. So some of the things that get me most excited in this role, we have at least three people who are looking to buy their first house. And with that knowledge, every time one of them closes a deal, and actually one of them just signed a new customer today, it gets me that much more excited, because I know that their success is having an impact in their significant other's life, their entire family's life. So now I look at success as helping my team, being in service to them, helping the company on a broader level, especially in times like these, is really exciting, as a lot of companies are struggling and having to deal with things like layoffs, being able to continue hitting numbers so that you can continue hiring and providing jobs for others is probably the most exciting thing. And then beyond that, thinking about growing a category as we're looking to grow consent-based marketing, and thinking years from now, taking this international, potentially IPO, something like that would be exciting. I do sometimes late at night think about ringing the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange someday, and that gets me pretty excited.
I love it. And I love how that's still all tied back to the team success, the company success, the client's success, I mean, the whole mission that we talked about. Last question, the journey or the destination?
Great question. I'd have to say the journey, because while the destination is exciting, it's the pursuit of that destination or the pursuit of the mission that to me is the most fun. As I think about ringing the opening bell, after that, I ask myself, what's next? And what exciting problems would you be solving then? And I juxtapose that with the exciting problems that we're thinking about right now as we're growing a team, as we're building out a new category. And right now, it's just so much fun. I wouldn't change it for anything else. For me, it kind of ties back to, it sounds cheesy, but The Secret, they talk about throwing out what you want to the universe, but then also recognizing when that's coming to fruition and when that's happening, especially as you're closing out a quarter and everything seems to be going crazy. I try to remind myself to step back for a moment and just think about how much fun and how exciting this is right now. And the journey that we're on is, to me, the most exciting thing.
That's awesome. I so appreciate that answer and what you said. So, Adam, I know that the best thing for people to do, they can find you on LinkedIn. Obviously, we got introduced by Ruben, and then we've chatted there. So they can find you, Adam Chickman, on LinkedIn, and then also on activeprospect.com, which is the company site, so they can find more about that. Adam, thanks again for coming on the Authentic Persuasion Show. Thanks for sharing all this from sales, from leadership, mindset. I truly appreciate that, and I'm super excited for where you're going to go, especially with what you're bringing to teams. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason. I've had a great time.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode, and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.